All right, so this is Bio 231. It's Monday. This is our third session, and it is August 23rd. And we are in chapter 2. We're probably done talking about most of the organelles inside the cell, what their functions are. So make sure that you're familiar with this exam figure right here. Where is it? On the other screen someplace. I got to be able to get it up on this screen. Where is it disappearing to? Hold on, let me try to punch this button here. There, it's just not projecting. Send me an email with your student number so I can forward that. Okay, good. Oh, for crying out loud. Aha! Got it. So you need this over here. You need this here. And you need this over here. Okay. And I need this there. Okay, sorry, there's some intermittent connection problems with the screens, but I think we're good enough to go here. What else is there? This you need over here. Okay, so I think we left off someplace around chromosomes. Okay? And what we're interested in looking at, okay, where do we find chromosomes? In the nucleus, right? So we talked about all these different organelles. So I remember what I was saying. Make sure that this is a very important exam figure, so make sure you can label all of these structures by their correct name, but also know at least a couple bullet points what their function is. Like, for instance, if there is a pointer right here, you would say for the structure, you would say mitochondria, and then for the function, you would say produces ATP or is the powerhouse for the cell, produces energy for the cell, right? And if I have a cursor pointing here, for structure, you would say rough endoplasmic reticulum, and the function is protein synthesis. And furthermore, you should know that the membrane itself is not responsible for producing proteins, but these little dots, which you see associated with the rough ER, the same dots you see in the cytoplasm right here, those are ribosomes, and those are the things that can produce proteins. We're going to look at that process in a little bit of detail. So there are two different ways, or there are two different fates for proteins that are produced by the cell. By free ribosomes, these end up inside the cell. When it's a protein made by rough ER, that means it goes through this secretory pathway into the Golgi apparatus, where it is, what's the function of a Golgi apparatus? Two words, modifying and packaging into secretory vesicles, and then those modified proteins are secreted from the cell, right? Okay, so that's what a Golgi looks like. And don't forget, on the exam, these pictures are going to be in living color. No, just black and white. Grayscale, right? Grayscale. So don't memorize just by color. And then this endoplasmic reticulum. What is this one here? Smooth. Is smooth ER? What's the function of smooth ER? And I want you to know two functions. And then I think I maybe told you one. Makes lipids. And another important function is that it stores calcium. Stores calcium. Okay. These other vesicles inside the cell, sometimes they're lysosomes. That means it's an intracellular digestive system. Lysozyme breaks down complex biomolecules. There can also be peroxisomes here that is important for detoxifying. Right? So vesicles, depending on what's inside of them, could be for digestion or detoxification, depending on whether it has lysozyme or peroxidase. And then we got microfilaments and microtubules. They give the cell its internal skeleton, right? They give the cell its shape. They can also act as a motility system for moving organelles around inside the cell. So it acts like a little monorail system. All right, so that takes us to the nucleus. And the nucleus contains the genetic material of the cell. It contains chromosomes. Chromosomes are made out of DNA and some proteins. DNA is the genetic material, and DNA will contain genes. Genes will determine what kinds of proteins this particular cell can make, and then, of course, depending on what kind of proteins the cell makes, determines how many and what kinds of proteins are in your body. So it determines how your body is made, and also then how it functions as well. Okay, the active part of the nucleus is the nucleolus right here, and it's a little bit denser underneath a light microscope, so it's kind of easy to pick out. Now, the cell has a cycle, a life cycle it goes through. The part of the life cycle that's the longest is what we call interphase, in which the genetic material, the thin strands of DNA, are pulled off of a chromosome. They're very, very long, filamentous, and very delicate, and they can be damaged. So that's why this information is behind this membrane that we call the nuclear envelope. So the nuclear envelope protects the DNA when it's being used from all the activity that's happening in the cytoplasm. Oh, and remember, last time we said cytoplasm has two main components to it. What were the two main components of cytoplasm? You've got organelles and cytosol, the fluid part. So if you put these hard structures, some of them have membranes around them like mitochondria, some don't like centrioles, and the fluid part, which is cytosol, put that all together, we call that cytoplasm, right? That's just the living material that is outside the nucleus but inside the plasma membrane. Okay. All right, so when it's an interphase, I don't see any chromosomes because the DNA is pulled off of chromosomes so that it can be used. And this is what it looks like. Let's look at the structure. Okay, we're going to look at, so here we are in the slide. So we're going to look at the structure of chromosomes right now. So the structure of a chromosome looks something like this. Okay, so here is a chromosome right here, and this is actually a replicated chromosome. There are two copies of it. Here is one copy, and then here is the other copy, and they're connected together at the centromere. Because cells are going to grow and divide, and each cell should get a copy. These two copies are going to split apart. When DNA is in a condensed form, like this, packaged with proteins, it's in a very, very safe form. We call that condensed, and it does not have to be behind a nuclear envelope to be protected. All right, but when chromatin gets pulled off of a chromosome, now you can see these strands right here, all right, and here is DNA, and you can see that there are actually two strands that form the DNA molecule. So DNA is characterized as being double-stranded. It can be used to make proteins, but it can be damaged. So we call this extended chromatin right here, where it's in a very useful form to make proteins, but it can be damaged. And this kind of chromatin will be found only during interphase of the cell cycle, and that's when the nuclear envelope has integrity. It's completely surrounding all of this material. All right, when the cell starts to divide, this extended chromatin is packaged with these histone molecules, and coiled and coiled and coiled, and then it's super coiled, and then it's packaged with some more proteins to form this chromosome right here. Then that information can't be used to make proteins, but at least it's in a safe form, and the nuclear envelope can disappear, and the cell can undergo mitosis. So here we have condensed chromatin, and then up over here we have extended chromatin. This is the useful form, but what's the trade-off to having useful DNA? What can happen to this DNA? Can be damaged, right? Over here we have condensed chromatin, can't be used, but what's the trade-off? What's the good aspect of that? Right? It's in a safe form, right? It's in a very safe form, all right, for different kinds of purposes. And the proteins that are used to take extended chromatin and package it in condensed chromatin is what we call histones, right? Histone proteins. So chromosomes don't just contain DNA, they also contain some proteins, and those proteins also regulate what kind of chromatin comes off of a chromosome to help regulate protein synthesis. You'll learn about that in a physiology class. And if you have four or eight of these histone molecules with the chromatin wrapped around it, we call that a nucleosome. And that's regulated as well when it comes on and off, these molecules. Okay. Ooh, good. I was able to grab it up there somewhere. Oh, I can go over here and I can hit this. Good, 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 good. Okay, so you should know the difference between condensed, extended chromatin, the histone proteins, and the building block of, what's the building block of any kind of protein? Amino acid, right? And the building block of DNA is always going to be sometimes we call them nucleotides. Sometimes we call those nucleotides. Okay, so let's talk about movement across the plasma membrane. So that cell that we were looking at, let's see if I can show both of these at the same time. All right, here's that picture of that nice cell. Okay, so this plasma membrane right here acts as a barrier for most molecules. And so the cell can determine what will leave, will go from the intracellular side to the extracellular side, and which can enter, which can go from extracellular to intracellular. One of the ways that things can move is by a passive process, right? And other things move by an active process. Passive means that it doesn't take any energy for things to move. So for instance, if I have this mouse right here and I push it off the edge of the table, does it take any energy for it to move from the table to the floor? It will just happen automatically. That's what we call a passive process. All right, so now I got my mouse down on the floor, And if I push it over to the table, will it just hop onto the table by itself? No, it needs energy. You need to expend energy to get the cursor up onto the tabletop. That would be an example of an active process, right? So there are two kinds of processes, either passive, that just happen automatically, or active, that require require energy. And in the cells, what is the form of energy that's available there? ATP. And where does ATP come from? Mitochondria, right? Okay. And mitochondria need oxygen and other nutrients like glucose in order to make ATP. Okay, so how do molecules move from one place to another? With passive transport. The first process is what we call diffusion. Molecules will move from high concentration to low concentration. And does that require energy when things move from high to low? Okay, let's consider I have a perfume bottle at the front of the room, and I take the cover off the perfume bottle. Okay, there's high concentration of perfume inside the bottle, but what about the back of the room over there? Is there any of that perfume in the back of the room? No, there's a big concentration gradient. It's high in the front of the room, low in the back. So even though there's no fan blowing the perfume around, guess what's going to happen as soon as I open up the bottle? First, you're going to smell it. Then the second row is going to smell it. Then the third row and fourth row and fifth row. So that perfume is going to completely permeate this whole room over time. It might take maybe overnight to do that. But if we were to come in the morning, we would find that this room has an even concentration of perfume due to diffusion. Molecules will move from high to low even though there's no air blowing it around. And the same thing will happen in a solution, a water solution. Molecules can move through a water solution just by diffusion. So let me see if I have a slide of that. I don't think I have a slide. Things will move from... from high to low. Well, this might be a fairly good example. If we were to count the number of particles right here, can you tell that there are more particles above the membrane compared to below? They're almost the same, but I would say there's probably three or four more above the membrane, which means then that these molecules are going to have a tendency to move across the membrane just on the basis of concentration, going from high concentration to low concentration. Okay, and that would be an example of a passive process. Okay, the second term has to do with osmosis, or the second term on your slide is osmosis. And is that passive or active process? That's a passive process as well. But there are three criteria, and I'll write these on the board, that determines whether something is simple diffusion or osmosis. The first criteria is that things have to move from high concentration to low. So what does that mean when something moves from high concentration to low? Ooh, I don't want to grab any of these fancy ones because we just have our projector working. Oh, that's good enough. Okay, if something goes from high to low, what do we call that? Just in everyday, every general circumstance, is that active or passive? Passive, right? So we would call this diffusion. Okay, so osmosis has to be diffusion, number one. Okay. Number two, it can't be any kind of molecule. It always has to be H2O. What's that? Water. It's only the water molecule. Salts or sugars or anything like that moving across the membrane cannot be osmosis. It's got to be water. Okay, and the third criteria is that water will move from what? High to low, right? Across a membrane. There's got to be some kind of membrane right there. And in particular, the kind of membrane is what we call semi-permeable. Semi-permeable membrane. So it will leave some things enter the cell, but it will exclude other kinds of molecules. So if all three of these conditions are met, then what do we call that? We call that osmosis, right? We call that osmosis. Wow, this would have been a really nice lecture if I had two projectors working, okay? So osmosis is the diffusion of water. That's kind of a loaded term. So when we say diffusion, what does that mean? High to low, passive. Water means, well, H2O, and across a semi-permeable membrane. It's got to be a special membrane that excludes some things from moving across. And guess what? Cell membranes are semi-permeable membranes. Okay. That takes us to another kind of transport process across membranes, and that's an active process requiring energy. There is a special, this name right here, adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, means that there's a molecule, adenosine, and bound to it is a phosphate molecule. But more importantly, how many phosphate molecules are bound to adenosine triphosphate? Three, okay? And we can rip off one of those phosphates, the terminal phosphate, and end up with adenosine with two, adenosine diphosphate, and then here's that one phosphate group that's left floating around inside the cell. Right, and the chemical bond that was broken releases a lot of energy, and that energy can be used for the cell's purposes, like for conducting electrical impulses or contracting muscle, but in this particular case, it can be used for transporting molecules across the cell membrane. And that's why I have for transport right here. So that ATP can be used for transport across the cell membrane. It can be maybe simple molecules, maybe, for instance, like glucose or sodium and potassium, but it can also be for very large molecules, all right? So, for instance, if we have that door right there, okay, and we had a car in this room, that car couldn't fit through that doorway because it's too big. So a cell has another way of moving big molecules, and that's by actually forming another room that the car can drive in, and then that room gets assimilated on the other side of the wall. We call that macromolecular transport. And since we're pushing and pulling on membranes, right, guess what that needs? That needs ATP to make those different changes in the membrane. There are three kinds of macromolecular transport. There's something called phagocytosis, right? Cytosis just means some kind of cellular process taking place. It means a process inside the cell. Phago right here just means eating. It's a Greek word for eating. Cytosis and pinocytosis is what? Some kind of cellular process. Pino means drinking, cell drinking. So in this particular case, the cell is not eating large, big molecules, but is actually drinking fluid in. And then phagocytosis and pinocytosis are examples of, all right, so phago and pinocytosis are examples of endocytosis. What does cytosis mean again? Yeah, it's a cellular process. And endo means bringing something inside the cell. So cell eating, cell drinking, bringing inside the cell, as opposed to the reverse process, which we call exocytosis, which is the reverse process, that's the cell secreting something. Okay, and we look at that secretory pathway. Can anybody tell me something about that secretory pathway? Where does it begin? Where does a secretory pathway inside of a cell begin? Where is that at? Okay, it begins with rough endoplasmic reticulum making some kind of protein. That protein then gets transported into the Golgi apparatus where it's modified, right, and packaged into secretory vesicles. Now this vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane. How does it move from the Golgi over to the plasma membrane? It hops a ride on a microtubule, and when it touches the cell membrane, the membranes fuse together because they're made of the same components, and then the inside contents then just move out of that little compartment right here for going from high concentration to low concentration. So that process we would say is diffusion. So exocytosis, right, is by diffusion once this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane. But Moving this vesicle around inside the cell requires energy, requires ATP. So that's why exocytosis is not a passive process, that is an active process, because it costs energy to move this vesicle around. Okay. The reverse of that, the reverse of exocytosis is phagocytosis or pinocytosis. So think in the reverse direction, where these are big molecules outside the cell. They'll diffuse into this area right here, okay, because there might be high concentration here, low concentration there, and then the cell pinches away, this vesicle pinches away from the cell membrane, and now you have these macromolecules trapped inside the vesicle inside the cell. So that would be cell eating, for instance. Okay, and so you can see various kinds of active processes, like on this slide right here. Okay, so let's just say these are water molecules right here that the cell is taking up, and then it pinches away into this vesicle. What would that be called? There's different ways you could talk about it. The general form would be what? Endocytosis. And then furthermore, what kind of endocytosis would that be? That would be pinocytosis. But if these molecules were big macromolecules, you would say phagocytosis, which is a specific kind of endocytosis, right? Okay. Okay, so those are transport across the plasma membrane. Okay, let's talk about protein synthesis and just a couple general ways. Okay, and I'm going to start you off with something that's called the central dogma of biology. Okay, there are four basic kinds of biological molecules in your body. Proteins is one kind of general biological molecule, and you probably know what the building block of a protein is right now, without taking this, probably in grade school everybody knows. Well, maybe not everybody. What's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acid, hopefully that might ring a bell, right? So the basic building block of protein is an amino acid. Then we have another kind of organic molecule that we call nucleic acids. And RNA and DNA are both nucleic acids. And I don't know if anybody knows what the building block of RNA and DNA are. Just like amino acid is a building block of a protein, building block of a nucleic acid is a nucleotide. That's a nucleotide. So you put a bunch of amino acids together, you get what? A protein. You put a bunch of nucleotides together, you get something that's either RNA or DNA. The nucleotides are very, very similar. Okay, and then just for fun, does anybody have an idea of what other kinds of biological compounds, organic compounds? You got proteins, nucleic acids, and then you have lipids is another class, and another big class are sugars or carbohydrates. Right? So most biological molecules in your body can be broken down into those four kinds: sugars, lipids, nucleic acids, and proteins. Okay. Well, how do we make a protein? Well, yeah, there are amino acids, and there are about 20 different kinds of amino acids, and they have to be put together, right, in just the right way to build the correct protein. Just like, what do you use to make a word, like protein? What do you need? What's the basic building block of words? Letters, right? So think of amino acids as being like letters to make a particular word. And if you change the sequence of letters in a word, what happens to that particular word? Well, it changes. It changes the meaning, right? So the same thing with a protein. If you change the sequence of amino acids that make a protein, you change its shape, and then you're going to change its function, because its function is determined by its particular shape. Well, how does a cell know what amino acids to put next to each other to spell a protein correctly so it has the right shape? Well, the spelling is contained in DNA, because these nucleotides that make DNA have a particular spelling as well. There's a particular arrangement, a particular sequence of nucleotides in DNA that will determine the particular sequence of amino acids in this protein right here. Okay. Now, where do we find DNA at? Inside the nucleus. Why is it trapped inside the nucleus? Yeah, because it's protected. Because if somebody rearranges the sequence of nucleotides in that DNA, then that's going to change how you spell this protein that's made. It changes the structure. It's going to change the function. And in most cases, that's very harmful to the cell. It's deleterious to the cell. It might kill the cell. So that information in DNA has to be protected, right? Like if you have a computer program on your computer and the power went off right when you're using that program and it puts some kind of funny language, a glitch in the computer program, then the program's not going to work. You got to reload the program. Well, there's no way to reload information into the DNA of a cell. Either it's going to function properly or not, and if not, then probably it's going to die. Okay. So information is contained in DNA. That's why we say it's the blueprint for the cell. And that should stay within the nucleus. But how do we get that information, okay, to the those cellular structures that make proteins? So furthermore, tell me, what kind of structures can make proteins inside of a cell? What are the organelles? Ribosomes, and of course you can have the free ribosome or the ribosome on the rough ER, right? So how do we get that information from DNA, which is trapped inside the nucleus, to those ribosomes? That's what this step right here is all about. Okay. So when you look at this central dogma right here, how many steps does it look like? Okay. How many arrows do you see? I see two arrows right here. And are these arrows pointing in one direction or two directions? One direction. They always go in one direction. Okay. So when we say dogma, we mean that we're telling you something that you should not challenge. Right? You should just accept it forever and ever in your life, that nothing changes. Okay. But in science, is that possible? Okay. No, because we always learn more and more every day. This dogma right here, just appreciate it for a starting point in biology. Okay? And in this class, you don't really have to consider anything else. That protein synthesis, right, requires two steps, and it always goes in this direction. The proteins that are made inside your cells will be determined by the DNA that's inside the nucleus. Right? The proteins that are in our body cannot be used to rearrange or rewrite the blueprint that defines how you're made, right? Because these are just a one-way street. And personally, that's a really good thing because, for instance, maybe tonight you're going to go home and have a chicken dinner or something and you're going to eat a lot of chicken proteins. Do you have to worry about waking up in the morning with feathers and a beak? No, because the proteins that you take inside your body cannot influence your DNA. You're still you right in the morning when you wake up, okay? So this process of making proteins always starts with DNA. The information in DNA gets converted into RNA, and then RNA gets converted into a protein. Okay, so information always flows, DNA into proteins. And we say it's what? A two-step process. You got to know the names of these steps right here. Okay, the best way to appreciate the names of these steps is to know what the building blocks are for these compounds. And the building block of DNA is what? Nucleotide. What's the building block of RNA? Nucleotide. Okay? So DNA and RNA are really, it's spelled with the same letters, so the language is the same. The language of DNA and RNA is the same language. All right, so when you have a piece of paper in one language and you want to make another copy of it, what do we call that process? For instance, in admissions and records, they have a copy of all the grades that you've got in various classes, right? And you might need to take that and show an employer or another college. So you call admissions, and what do you ask for? A transcript. And what's a transcript? Just a photocopy of your record. It's an exact duplicate, okay? So this first step right here, we call transcription. It's basically an exact copy of the information that's in DNA. Right? It's like a photocopy. Because why? The building blocks are exactly the same. It's the same language. So this first step is what we call transcription. All right. So what's the beauty of that? Well, here is a copy of the information. This RNA now can leave the nucleus into the cytoplasm where it can be damaged. But is that such a big deal? Is that a horrific event if it gets damaged? No, because the original information, the DNA is still there. And the cell can go back to the DNA and ask for more RNA, can transcribe more RNA, right? But the original information is still protected behind the nuclear envelope. Think of the nucleus as like being the reserve section of the library that has books, right? You can check them out. You can't take them out of the library, right? But you can at least use them in the library where they're protected and they won't get lost. Okay. So the first step, transcription, that's converting DNA to RNA. Where does that happen? Where is DNA always located? Inside the nucleus. So that always happens inside the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm, right? Never inside the cytoplasm. So that's the first step. There are three kinds of RNA that are made, right? There's messenger RNA. This contains the spelling of how to put a protein together. It's just a long sequence of nucleotides that determines how many and where different amino acids will be placed into a protein. There's ribosomal RNA. This is where a protein is actually made. Think of it as the workbench. All right? So this messenger RNA has to attach itself to the workbench. And that workbench then starts to build a protein. And you could have, free ribosomes? Or you could have ribosomes on the endoplasmic reticulum. And the third kind of RNA is what we call transfer RNA. What does this workbench need from the cytoplasm in order to make a protein? Another way of asking that question is, what's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acid. So these transfer RNAs are floating around in the cytoplasm, grabbing an amino acid and bringing them over to the workbench so it can be added to a protein that's being made. Right? So that's why we call it a transfer RNA. And sometimes I like to call it a taxi RNA, right? A taxi or transfer RNA's job is to bring amino acids to the ribosome so that a ribosome can make a protein based on the information that is in this messenger RNA. So that's what transcription makes, all these different kinds of RNAs. And where does that happen? Inside the nucleus. All right, so you might be wondering, well, how do all these things get outside of the nucleus? Well, I guess I go back to this picture right here. Because there are nuclear pores in the envelope right here. These are big tunnels that allows RNA to leave, but not these super huge DNA molecules, right? That's why we have these nuclear pores right here. Okay. All right, so how many step process is protein synthesis? Two. First step, transcription, and it happens inside the nucleus. The second step does not happen inside the nucleus. It happens where? On ribosomes that are in the cytoplasm someplace. And that step we call translation. All right, so what the heck does translation mean? Just literally, what does translation mean? It means that we have some information that's in one language and you convert it to another language. All right, like going from English to French or Farsi to Arabic or, who knows? Pick any two languages. Of course, in order to translate, you need to have somebody that can speak both languages that knows the translation, if it is really translation, right? So if you're going from Farsi to English, right, what about the information in Farsi compared to the information in English? Will it be different? Or will it be the same? The language is different, but the information should really be the same. Okay, so if you use a translator that really knows both languages, right, they can take information from one person and convey that information to another person, even though it's in a different language. So that's what translation does. It goes from one language to another, but the information doesn't change. Now, why do we say that it's a different language? What's the building block of RNA? The language of RNA is a nucleotide, but what's the language of a protein? Amino acid. So you're going from one language to another language, therefore we call that translation. Now, where does that happen? The clue is, where do you have ribosomes? Cytoplasm. Not in the nucleus, okay? And never in the nucleoplasm. Okay, so that's what I want you to know about protein synthesis. You got to know, how many steps is it? Two. How does information flow? DNA to RNA to protein. Okay, the first step is called transcription because you're making an exact copy of it, right? DNA and RNA are basically the same kind of molecule. The second step, translation, because you're changing the language. You're going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. And that happens in the cytoplasm on the workbench, which is the ribosome, made up of ribosomal RNA, and there's some other proteins that are thrown in there too to make the workbench work. Okay, the taxi RNAs bring amino acids to the workbench to make a protein, and how you spell a protein out, or what the sequence of amino acids is determined by the messenger RNA. Okay, so that's kind of it in the whirlwind nutshell, but that's what I want you to know in this particular class. Okay. Who's got a question on that? That was pretty fast. But that's really the important bullets that I want you to know. And that will serve you well to have that good basic understanding of protein synthesis. All right? Don't forget, how many steps? Mm-hmm. 2 particular steps. Now, let's talk about the cell cycle. And in the cell cycle, we're going to talk about cell division. Okay? Protein synthesis only happens during a certain phase of the life cycle of a cell, and that's during interphase, because interphase is a growth phase, okay? And then the cell can enter mitosis, and mitosis is a form of reproduction. Mitosis and reproduction can sort of be used synonymously. So I would like to make sure that you understand why is reproduction or mitosis important for a living organism? There are 2 reasons. I mentioned this in lab, so maybe you can flash back to lab. 2 important reasons. Yeah, because at one point in time, what were we? Okay, here we have a little sperm from your dad. Here's a little egg from your mom. They got together, right? There are 23 chromosomes here, 23 chromosomes here. They fuse together to form this cell with 46 chromosomes. All right, what is that process called when these two fuse? These are what we call gametes. These 2 gametes fuse. This is fertilization. The process is fertilization, right? But the name of this single cell is a zygote. All right, I don't think I'll ask you that, but this is just really good biology to know. All right, so fertilization, that's a zygote. And that's a living cell, right? It's a living human cell, but it's not a very interesting living human cell. Why is that? Because if you were just a zygote, you can't come to anatomy class. You couldn't look through a microscope or take notes or anything, right? So how do you get from a zygote to a multicellular organism with trillions of cells that can, right, look through a microscope and take notes and all that kind of stuff? That is mitosis. That process of going from one cell to trillions of cells, somebody said before, is growth, right? So going from one cell to you right here, right? That is mitosis, and that process is growth. So that's one important reason for mitosis, to get big. And what's another important reason? Replace old and damaged cells, right? We use an example of red blood cells. They only live for about 120 days. You lose about 2 million every second, so you have to replace 2 million cells every second in your body. That's done by mitosis. You can take the battery out. Okay, I think I still have my phone turned on too. It's amazing. Mine is off. Good. Okay. So that's the reason for mitosis. So let's talk about some of the details of mitosis then. Well, mitosis, you start with one cell. Okay. You start with a single cell. And you end up with how many? 2. Okay. So I think I drew this in lab, so I probably don't want to draw it again. All right. But there's 46 chromosomes in this parent cell. How many chromosomes are going to be in this daughter cell? 46. And how many in this other daughter cell here? 46, right? So all of these cells will be identical. So mitosis is a way of producing identical cells. Okay? which is, if you look around the room, and if you look at everybody else in the room, do you see anybody identical in here? No. So different people are formed, not through the process of mitosis. That's a process of meiosis. That means that everybody's different. All right. But mitosis would make everybody the same. All right. So sexual reproduction is different than asexual reproduction, and mitosis is a form of asexual reproduction, right? Making everything the same. Sexual reproduction means that everybody's different by chance. Okay, so mitosis has five, actually the cell cycle has five important phases. These last four are the active part of mitosis, right? So you have to know the names of these phases and the correct sequence. And so this little acronym, IPMAT, will help you remember the sequence of the steps of mitosis, which stands for interphase, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase with cytokinesis, right? And meta means, what does meta mean? Middle phase. Telo means the end phase. Yeah, last phase, right? Okay. And then we got to know something about the difference between cytokinesis and mitosis. So let's look at these things. This first phase of the cell cycle right here is a growth phase. Okay, and that's signified by this green arching arrow right here. Notice that that's the longest arrow. That means that most of the life of the cell is spent in interphase growing, right? G1 is just a growth phase where cytoplasm and organelles are replicated, making duplicate copies, or maybe even more than just duplicate copies, making four or five copies. This S phase in the middle, this is another growth phase. This is where the DNA becomes replicated, okay? Because if we have 46 chromosomes in the parent cell and we end up with 46 in the daughter cells, and we got two daughter cells, we have to split the chromosomes, but we don't want half the number of chromosomes in each cell. We want the same number, so they have to be replicated here. And then G2 is just the final preparations for mitosis. This is interphase. All right? And during this phase, protein synthesis takes place. And so protein synthesis is taking place. All right? What is the nature of the DNA? Is it extended or is it condensed? Okay. Is it packaged tightly in chromosomes that you can see underneath a light microscope, or is it all pulled off of the proteins so that it can be used for that first step of protein synthesis? Okay. It is extended. And since it's extended during interphase, you don't see any chromosomes because all the chromatin is pulled off of the histones and it's being used to make proteins. Okay. Oh, what's that first step of protein synthesis called that happens inside the nucleus? Just for fun. What did we call that? That is DNA to RNA. What's that called? Or DNA to RNA. That's transcription, right? Transcription, just making a photocopy. That's what happens during interphase because you need more proteins when that cell is growing. Okay. And then we enter, when the cell's ready to divide, it enters prophase, right? And then it slips into metaphase and then anaphase, telophase, and then the cell's ready to split apart. So I do want you to know these different steps, all right, and what they look like, right? Because you'll maybe get some pictures like this on the practicum next week. Yeah, you all have a practicum next week. All right, so here we see a cell, and it has some really fancy dyes. What was the name of the dye that we used in lab? Methylene blue. It just stained something blue, but it didn't turn pretty colors or fluoresce. It never turned fluorescent, okay? But this kind of stain does. The DNA fluoresces this nice blue color. And when you look inside the nucleus right here, do you see any chromosomes? No, this chromatin is what we say is extended. It's being used for protein synthesis because what phase does protein synthesis take place? Interphase, right? So this is a growth phase. All right, and when the cell's ready to divide, right, there's some checkpoints, and then the cell starts to divide, but the nuclear envelope is going to disappear. What better happen to all this extended chromatin if the nuclear envelope is going to disappear? It better condense into a chromosome, be packaged so that it's safe, so that it can't be damaged by all the stuff that's happening in the cytoplasm. So the first step, prophase, right, is condensation of extended chromatin into condensed chromatin or chromosomes, And now if you look in here, can you see the beginnings of some chromosomes? You can see some structures, some wormy things in there. Those are chromosomes that are forming. Right, so this is, and you see the centrioles over here, which don't forget organized microtubules. They start to split apart, microtubules start to attach to them, and then one centriole will move over to the opposite end of the nucleus that we see over here. Microtubules will form between the centrosome complexes, and we call this prophase. Right, I don't think I would ask you the difference between lay, early and late prophase, but now you can see definitely what? Condensed chromatin, the nuclear envelope has disappeared, and these chromosomes now start to attach themselves to these microfilaments. And the centrosomes with the microfilaments are what we call the spindle apparatus. They connect at the centromere, right? And there's some apparatus there that we call the kinetochore at the centromere that the microtubules attach to. And what's the job of these microtubules when they attach to these chromosomes? What do? Yeah, transport, right? They move them around. And during anaphase, these chromosomes are just going to have a very random orientation. They're going to be wherever they were, sort of in the nucleus when mitosis started. But things have to become ordered in order for mitosis to work properly. So these microtubules push and pull on the chromosomes, so eventually they'll all end up right on the equator of the cell, which then signifies metaphase, right? So here I see all the chromosomes lined up right on the equator of the cell, perfectly formed spindle apparatus right here, no nuclear envelope, nice condensed chromatin, and this is the shortest phase of mitosis. All right, but it's the easiest to see, right? Do you see all these chromosomes lined up right in the middle? All right. Now, if you look here, let me zoom into this region right here. If you look at this area here, notice here is one bundle of chromatin. Here is another bundle of chromatin. So we call this one chromosome, but it's actually what? It's actually two that are connected together at the centromere. And so now these two, what we call daughter chromatids, can separate. They can be pulled apart. And this cell up over here will get one complete copy of the chromosome, and this one down here will also get one complete copy of it. Now, when did this DNA become replicated? What phase of the cell cycle? Which one is the growth phase? Interphase, right? So it happened during interphase, before mitosis started. Oh, I can use a little wheel right there. Nice. All right, then the next phase is characterized by the separation of these daughter chromosomes. So here they were called daughter chromatids because they were connected together. As soon as they're pulled apart, they're independent chromosomes, so now we call those daughter chromosomes. They will end up in two different, what? Daughter cells, but don't forget that they're going to have the exact same complement in DNA in both of them. Okay, this last phase right here is where the chromosomes, these daughter chromosomes, have been completely pulled over to the opposite pole of the cell that's been dividing. The spindle apparatus starts to dissolve away. The nuclear envelope starts to reform again because this DNA is going to be used to make proteins and it's got to be protected. And furthermore, these cells start to pinch apart. And when they pinch apart, it forms this cleavage furrow, right, a depression on the equator of the parent cell, and then, of course, there are microtubules in here that pull things together kind of like a noose, and the cytoplasm gets separated into these two daughter cells. So the separation of cytoplasm, which means what? Organelles and cytosol get separated into two daughter cells with the formation of this cleavage furrow as it gets deeper and deeper and deeper. That's what we call cytokinesis. Cytokinesis is separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. Maybe a good way to think of mitosis is what? The separation of DNA into two daughter cells. So that each daughter cell has the proper amount of cytoplasm, which is what? The right organelles. They didn't get cheated out of any organelles or cytosol. And furthermore, it has the right number of chromosomes. Neither daughter cell gets cheated out of a chromosome because then it doesn't have the correct blueprint to stay alive. Okay? Okay, so that kind of is mitosis. Now, in this other previous diagram, it's a little bit complicated. Notice that they kind of tack on cytokinesis. a little bit in anaphase and all through telophase and even extending past telophase a little bit. All right, in this class, I want you to know where cytokinesis takes place in just one phase of mitosis. And if you were to pick the best example of the phase of mitosis that cytokinesis takes place in, what would you choose? Telophase. Yeah, you want to say telophase, that's fine. Okay? And that's great for this class. So just say that cytokinesis takes place during telophase, should anybody ask you. Okay? This diagram probably will be debated for the next 300 or 400 years, figuring out what cells does cytokinesis happen in anaphase and then continue, or if it's completed in telophase or not. Well, unfortunately, we can't wait around 500 years to figure that out for all circumstances, right? So we'll just define it right now. Cytokinesis happens during telophase. And does anybody have a question about the distinction between cytokinesis and mitosis? Raise your hand. What would you say? How about if I say DNA? What process are you going to say? I would say mitosis. Separation of DNA happens during mitosis. And if I say cytoplasm, you would say, oh, well, that separates during cytokinesis. Okay? Right, because separating that DNA takes all of these phases right here, but cytokinesis really only takes this one phase of mitosis. Alright, so, alright, you got the feeling for how I kind of like to give lectures in this class, and I want to, there's a sign-in sheet going around, don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet, okay? So I'll probably progress through the course pretty much like this, but next week we have a practicum in lab on histology, so I actually want to move into histology for a couple minutes to give you a background, so that we start developing an eye for what micrographs look like underneath the microscope. Okay, so I don't know if you printed out any information. I know I didn't have, maybe you had the pre-lecture reading assignment, but you weren't aware I was going to start talking about it. But start looking at that histology information right away. All right, and I can't get here much before class, because I'd really like to see you guys working with those pre-lecture reading assignments. And maybe you're getting an inkling right now that if you do the pre-lecture reading assignments, it really helps you in lecture, okay? So raise your hand if you think doing the pre-lecture reading assignment helps you with lecture. Is it a waste of time? It's not a waste of time. I know it's a little bit extra work, but it's extra work that I think will make your life easier if you do it, not harder, okay? Okay, so let me see about histology right here, and then we got to go over here, go up, up. Histology is 4. So we're going to skip chapter 3 because that's embryology. Okay. Histology. Nice. Here it is. Let's zoom a little bit. Let's do page width. And then we got to do something to make it visible. Okay, so chapter 4. All right, so maybe a good place to start is to think of that hierarchical organization that we looked at in the first chapter. Remember, we wanted to start with something small, and in physiology, we start with something even smaller than cells and organelles. We start with chemicals, right? We didn't start with too many chemicals in here, but that's really the smallest thing. And if we put chemicals together, we get organelles. And if we put a bunch of organelles together, we get a cell, which is the structural and functional unit of life. If something's alive, it's got to be made of cells. All right, so we're done with cells. So now we're going to put a bunch of cells together. And if we do that, we get a tissue, right? So histology is the study of tissues, and a tissue, right, is a group of cells that have a similar structure, which means they all kind of look the same, and then that follows that if they all kind of have the same structure, what does that tell you about their function? That function is basically the same too, right? All right, and furthermore, we're going to see some tissues where cells are not packed very close together, they're separated by a big distance, And if it's the same tissue, even all the junk that's between the cells looks the same and functions the same. All right, so that's what a tissue is, a group of cells performing all the same kind of function because they all have the same kind of structure. Okay, so histology is the scientific study of tissue structure and function, right? And structure and function are related to each other. The really good thing about histology is that there's only four kinds of tissues that make up your whole body. There is something called an epithelium, and an epithelium covers a surface, like the surface that we're all looking at on each other right now. That's an epithelium. Your skin is made up of epithelium. Or it can line a cavity. We talked about some cavities in the body. It has a lining that's epithelium. And furthermore, some epithelium can make glands, like thyroid gland or sweat glands, things like that. Those are made up of epithelium. So that's one kind. Let's move down to this one. Muscle tissue or muscular tissue. And all muscle tissue, there are maybe a couple different kinds, all have the same kind of function. And take a guess what the function of muscle tissue is. Like this one right here. When I went like that, that muscle got shorter. So muscle tissue is specialized for contraction. That's what muscle tissue is specialized for. Nervous tissue, on the other hand, it doesn't contract. Okay? Not like a science fiction. You've probably seen some science fiction movies, and when aliens are communicating with each other, their brains kind of wiggle back and forth, but not really. That doesn't really happen. Nervous tissue doesn't shorten, doesn't contract. It just sends electrical information very fast from one part of the body to the other. It sends electrical impulses or nerve impulses. All right, so muscles for shortening, nervous tissue for sending electrical impulses, and then connective tissue is used to connect different parts of your body together. All right? For instance, a tendon is connective tissue. It connects a muscle to a bone. And then there are ligaments that connects a bone to another bone. And then there's another kind of connective tissue that's blood. It would connect your heart to your lungs. Right? And that's a really interesting kind of connective tissue because it's not a solid. It's actually what? A liquid. It can flow. That's why it can connect your whole body, all the different cells of your body together. And then furthermore, we got something called a membrane. We're going to look at some membranes. A membrane is made out of a couple kinds of tissues, partly epithelium and partly connective tissue. So the first connective tissue we're going to look at, okay, is epithelium. So if you want to start looking at some of the, I called and the textbook wasn't in, but it might be in today. So I got to get this chapter. This chapter is not in Blackboard, but I'll get a copy of this fourth chapter and put it on there so that you can start to look at some of the plates, the micrographs of these various tissues right here, because that will be really important for the practicum. The practicum will be, of course, your body planes and cavities, the microscope, the real microscope on the table, but just pictures of these various tissues, and the pictures that I will use will come from your textbook or very, very similar kinds of pictures, all right? Something that look almost exactly like the pictures that are in your book, all right? So I'll get a copy of that. So on Wednesday, we're going to start talking about epithelium, all right, and then get into connective tissue. So do that pre-lecture reading assignment on tissues, and that will make your life a lot easier. Okay, thank you. Let me see if my recorder works. Looked like it recorded everything. Great.